Today on the show, we have the man, the myth, the legend, David Gray. So we're already hyping you up, right?
Yeah. That's enough of that now.
Enough of that, right? Yeah. Yeah, man. So I've been wanting to get you on the show for a while. I really appreciate you, you know, taking the time to do this. Got a couple questions for you here, but again, just as we were kind of chatting about, we're just going to shoot the shit and just talk about fitness and rehab and all that good stuff. So if you don't mind, everyone probably already knows you, but give us a little, the elevator pitch. Who are you? What do you do?
I'll try, Kyle. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it. I've heard good things about the podcast. I haven't been listening to too many podcasts myself, not industry podcasts at least. I've been trying to distance myself from it a little bit, especially since I started my own podcast. I'm like, oh, I just can't listen or talk. Yeah. I have to just listen to random business stuff usually, actually, or something like that. But I've heard great things about your podcast, so I'll definitely have to check out some of the episodes. People can probably hear that I'm a little bit under the weather. I'm a bit talking out of my nose here a little bit or something. So apologies to the people listening for that. But kind of a background, I suppose, on me is, the easiest way to put it is I just help people with their movement. Pain, how they feel about themselves, usually more active people, if I can, actually almost exclusively active people or people who want to be more active than they are at the moment and something is holding them back. And also people who are very, very active at the moment and they're just maybe not moving or performing like they would like to. And then also a mix of kind of, I wouldn't call that either of those two people like rehab necessarily. It's just like, okay, we'll just clean up a few things. And then I also do some rehab with usually athletes as well who have had a more significant injury, like an ACL or a series of hamstring injuries that maybe their club or their team or whatever is struggling to figure out, or there's just need an external set of eyes to help with something. So those are usually the types of clients I work with. Those are the type of clients I enjoy working with most, especially active people, because you don't have to convince them as much to actually do their homework. So that's quite nice for me. And yeah, I'm based in Ireland and we've been just moving a little bit more into the education space over the last couple of years as well, just trying to, not really, it wasn't really necessarily designed, but it was just more like people were interested in finding out why I do some of the things I do and why they do and stuff like that. And that's just been kind of a natural progression, and we're going a little bit more in that direction as well, because it's hard to, as you know, it's hard to scale your own services when you work with people just one-on-one. So that's where we're going. So so yeah, that's where we are at the moment, enjoying it. I'm sitting here in my little office in Ireland now, and it's a little bit chilly and windy outside, but things are good,
man. Yeah, it's, I feel like that's the natural progression. It's like, you, once you start doing something right, people are asking, hey, how do you do that? Like, I want to know, teach me your ways. So no, that's great. I'm curious, like, kind of talking about Ireland, and obviously you work online and then you do in-person stuff as well. But I guess just kind of jumping into it, man. What's your favorite? Do you like working more online with people or in person?
Good question. Probably in person, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It just allows you to see a little bit more, allows you to just like, for instance, I had a client there this morning. He traveled down. Actually, he came down yesterday, did a session with me. He's about 4 hours away. So he came down, stayed overnight, and then did another session this morning. And I'd done about 3 or 4 sessions with him online. He had like pretty nasty, supposed like hip impingement type of symptoms, and a shoulder issue as well. And we had been cleaning them up a lot online, but just when I saw him in person, you're just able to like, just grab someone and just put them into the position you need to, like, you know, just like, and it's not even a mobilization or a soft tissue thing. It's just like manually, like just putting their knee into a position as they're doing an exercise, or just using your hands as a constraint. So in person is more fun. It's healthier for me as well, because I've had like separate to everything else, but like I've had a lot of concussions and stuff playing sport, and if I stare at the screen for too long, I also have like a little bit of double vision in one of my eyes, so if I stare at the screen for too long, my body gets super compressed. It really doesn't like it. So that when we got very busy over COVID, that was like very good for our business, but very bad for me personally. I didn't feel too good at all, and it kind of crept up on me, to be honest. So like I enjoy working with people online. It definitely helped me become a much better coach. It helped me much more clear with my words, helped me be more clear with what I was looking at. And it also helped me maybe show or convince or help other people see that you can get these results online. For the most part, the results that we get online are as good, nearly, I would say, as in person, sometimes even better, because people just actually do their homework. They're not expecting anything magical from you in person, but in person is probably more fun, I would say.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I have a couple in-person clients. I primarily am online, and I totally understand the staring at the screen. I think, so I just went and got some new contacts, and my vision's gotten significantly worse since being totally online, staring at the screen, being, you know, this close to it. So that's like something I'm really trying to get a handle on. It's like going on walks, using my distance vision, all of that. But it creeps up on you, especially when you're just hammering out calls like back to back to back. It's like, man, like you just get that strain. And I feel like my forehead's like stuck and all together. It's tough.
It's bad for our human beings, like to be, I know people talk about like sitting, how bad it is for you. And we've kind of maybe debunked that a little bit over the last few years. And it's just about variety, but I do feel like your eyes looking at a screen, especially when it's up close. And especially I will say something that I realized even more recently, if I'm working on a screen, like I'm doing emails, which I don't like doing, I don't do too much of, but no matter what it is, it's not too bad. But if I'm looking at movement on a screen, so I'm actually assessing a client, trying to focus on the client's movement makes it way worse, way quicker. Especially if you're quicker movement, if they're doing plyometrics or anything like that, I'm trying to focus, whatever it is with like the pixelation on the screen, that makes it way, way, way worse. So I need to, after a couple of sessions, I need to, no matter what happens, I need to get outside and have a walk and use just like peripheral vision and stuff, and that opens my body up again quite quickly.
Do video games bother you? Or do you not play much?
I don't play much anymore. I did a lot. I don't know. Good question, actually. I don't know anymore.
Yeah.
I'm very good at FIFA. Excellent at FIFA. So I don't know. Maybe it doesn't bother me when I'm like winning. So I don't know.
Yeah, right. It's worth it at that point. You're like,
exactly.
That makes sense. Yeah, that's I totally get. I completely agree. I think it's that sort of combination of, and it's also just, it's tough, especially being a business owner. You get in these like flow states, mm-hmm. and then you're just staring at the screen. And you keep going, and then you look up, and it's like, oh man, like a huge chunk of time has passed, and it's like, well, I feel like crap. what do I do now? And so again, like going on a walk, I think that's a huge thing. Have you ever heard of, I forgot the guy's name. It'll come to me, but there's a website and it's called like endmyopia.com or something. And this guy talks about how he had like -8 like diopter in both eyes, like could hardly see anything. And he claims that using not vision exercises, but just like taking his contact prescriptions like under a power, mm-hmm. and it's like got him back to where he doesn't have to wear contacts anymore, mm-hmm. but it took him 2.5 years to like truly do it. And so it's mm-hmm. something that he like kind of teaches online, but it makes me wonder. And I actually saw some successes with it. Like I used to be like -3, -3.25 or something in this one, and then I got down to like -2 over the course of like a year. But of course, since COVID and everything, it's just shot back up. And I've definitely noticed my eyes being weaker, but it might be something to kind of look at. I think there's something there.
I think there's something there as well. And it makes sense that you're training your eyes, like you're weaning them back a little bit. But my eyesight is perfect.
Oh, excellent. You're lucky.
It's really good. It's just my my brain doesn't like the screen more so than my eyes. My eyesight is now, I haven't got tested in a while, but I still think it's pretty good. But I can actually feel my breathing change as I sit and look at a screen for too long.
That's interesting. That's
the concussion stuff though.
Gotcha. How many did you have? Can you count on both hands?
Probably like seven fairly.
Gotcha.
Probably five big enough ones and then two to three mini ones. I don't know how many, but yeah, that's playing a lot of sport will do that for you.
Yeah. Do you count like blacking out as like, that's a concussion probably?
That's a fairly significant blow to the head. I would usually have gotten quite nauseous with that as well, and then like you would have anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks of like fairly medium to severe symptoms where you're a little bit, you're groggy, you're dizzy, you're blah, blah, blah. But back in the day as well, I would have just continued to, you would take a week off or a few days off and then you just play again.
Yeah, go back to grinding. No, I completely understand. I remember there was the worst concussion I ever had. I was running, so I ran hurdles in high school and it was raining outside. So they made us practice inside on the tile floor. And stupid. And of course, I hit this hurdle and I literally snapped the hurdle in half with my foot. I hit it and I like blew right through it. But in doing so, I popped the hurdle up. It trips me and it's like a cartoon. It's insane. So I hit my head and then on the other side, the hurdle hit my other side of my head.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I had like two gnarly looking, I have nasty scars on my forehead, but I blacked out completely. Like they sent me to the trainer's office. I don't remember that walk at all. I just like woke up in there and I was like, oh my gosh. But from that, you know, they got me concussion protocols, but you know, schoolwork was tough. Like they started putting me on an Adderall prescription after that. Cause they said like, oh yeah, you have ADHD and all this, but come to find out it's probably that I had concussion symptoms for almost, I mean, months. My schoolwork went down. It was terrible. Yep. And I think we're better now, but I'm curious to hear, you know, if you have any thoughts on that or experience.
No, that's why when you look at someone with an injury history, when you look at someone, you're assessing like whatever it is, hip mobility or whatever, you have to look at these things for these things in the injury history. And even if you don't have the expertise to maybe know what to do about them or deal with them, you have to look for them because how can a brain feel like it's safe to afford more movement to your body if it feels like, and it understandably feels like, or your nervous feels like it needs to guard all of the time because for some reason when I was younger or once or several times, something came out of nowhere and smacked me in the head. And that's how your brain feels when you fell and hit your head off the ground. It's not necessarily like it doesn't necessarily, it might, but it doesn't necessarily just attribute that to, okay, we kicked the hurdle, we fell and we hit the ground. It might attribute that going forward to actually every single step we ever take for the rest of our lives, we are very scared of falling and hitting my head. So I'm going to lock my whole body up. Mm-hmm. So it's a really serious thing to think about when you're working with people that have limitations in their movement, either like, and these are subclinical things. It's not like I can't focus my eyes on something. It's just like, I'm really tight all of the time. Or there's some strange issues with coordination here that, not strange, but like you're just not super coordinated. And that's hard to define, but then you can kind of see it with some people where they're just not super coordinated. So that's, I'm certainly not an expert on it, but since I've had my own stuff going on, I've just become more aware of that. And I've seen that in more people a lot of people who are very tight, very, very tight. And like anything they do doesn't seem to help. You'll see that in their injury history.
Yeah. I've never thought of it. And like, I always think of like what's safe, what's not safe in the brain, always thinking that way, but not in terms of concussions. And that makes sense. I've always thought of it more as like, you know, your software, your hardware got, you know, smacked a little bit. So like things need some time to kind of settle down, but that makes, especially for like chronic cases, that makes total sense. And, you know, if you have, like I've worked with some football players and they can't even count how many concussions they've had. They're like, I'm like, how many times have you blacked out? And they're like, I gotta look to my toes instead of my hands, like to count them all. So it gets intense. But I kind of going from that into, you know, a little bit more of what you do and concussions and all of that. How do you view pain, you know, especially with this, the clientele that you work with in the patient caseload? Like, what's your view of pain? Is it just like a safety thing for the brain a lot of the times? Or, I mean, obviously there's acute and chronic, but yeah, I'll just very open-ended question.
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. I'm quite happy with our, I think I'm quite happy to say that I don't actually know, because I don't think anyone necessarily knows. It's quite complex. How I view it is, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that question, Kyle. Here's how I work with pain, I will say, for clients. I think we're at a stage with our clients where this is going to sound arrogant, and I'm going to loop around and explain what I mean. I feel like we can't lose with our clients anymore. And the reason I say that is when I work with someone who's in pain, I accept that I actually don't know what's going to help with your pain. I have a theory, I have some ideas here, and we'll just see what happens as we go along. But what I think we can say for most, with a lot of certainty for most people is, I think I can make you a good bit stronger in ways that maybe you haven't exposed your tissues to. I think I can make you like more coordinated. Again, that's hard to define, but like your smoothness of your movement smooths out. And I think I can make you more mobile if you need that. I think I can make you like more elastic, more springy, improve your plyometric qualities there. So I take the focus off pain with my clients, and I say in 2 months' time, so especially chronic pain, I should say, especially chronic pain, it's been going on for a few years. People have tried, usually by the time someone comes to me, they've tried a lot of different things and stuff. So I'll try and take the focus away from pain and say, okay, in 2 months' time, let's imagine that your pain is the exact same as it is today, but you're stronger. Your activity levels have gone through the roof. Maybe body compensation has improved. Cardio has improved. All of these things have improved. You're more mobile. Would you take that? Most people would say, yeah, I would take that, because over the previous 2 years, my pain has stayed the same or gotten worse. And actually what has happened is I've gotten weaker. I've gotten less mobile. I've gotten less active. I've gotten more neurotic around. I'm just focusing on pain all of the time, blah, 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 blah. So I feel like, and I try and explain that to my clients, that I actually feel like we can't lose if we focus on those things. And guess what? When we focus on those things and things like sleep and mindset, which just kind of comes along with just living a happier life and being happier in your body as well, then usually what I see is pain just decreases and oftentimes just goes away altogether, pain in that way, because I don't know which one of those things exactly needs to be the thing that was the exact thing that helped with your pain. I don't need to know that. I've matured enough, I think, to the stage where I don't need to play God with pain and say this is the exact root cause of your pain. I'm just going to improve the big elephants that are there, that are clearly obvious in someone's injury history, their training program, the way they speak about themselves and their body, all of these things. So you just tick away at those big elephants and pain seems to look after itself. And that's what I mean when I say I don't think we can lose, because I do think you can lose if you just have a focus on, can I get this person pain free? And that means after 2 months or 2 years, if they're not pain free, then they just look back and say, okay, the last 2 months was a complete waste. I wasted my time and my money. I have the same amount of pain, or I have more pain, and I'm no stronger. I'm not more mobile, blah, 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 any of these things. So that's how I view pain. I view it as we can hopefully improve it a lot of the time as a byproduct of just improving your life and your movement and your strength and all of these things along the way.
I think that's you use kind of like, you don't play God with pain, and that's something that can get sketchy real quick, right? Like you start to, I'm sure you've probably had similar experiences, but I get these people that are, they're looking for this one thing, the silver bullet, the quick fix. What is that one exercise that's going to just like somehow suck the pain out of their body? Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's not how this works. It's more of a, I think of it as like a secondary thing. Like it's there, it's real, but is that pain there actually the problem? Honestly, a lot of the times I see whatever the problem it is, it's probably a limitation on the opposite hip or something completely different that could be causing that. So it's hard as, you know, health providers too, just to be able to market and then also have these conversations with people, because it's, mm-hmm. you almost have to make these like kind of quick fix posts and marketing material, but at the same mm-hmm. time, then tell people, hey, it's not really about this.
Like, yeah. That, look, that's tricky. It's tricky. It does make you ponder like what type of message you're putting out there, and especially the type of people that you want to work with. Because when I see right. someone, there is just certain red flags in someone's, the way they write to you, or something they might fill in a form, which makes me feel like this person isn't ready for the approach that I want to take. And I'm at the stage now where I just, in the past, I would have probably still taken them on, but now I won't probably take them on. So, or I'll just recommend they go somewhere else or something mm-hmm. like that. So it does make me more targeted with my messaging. But what I will say is, that's not to say that I don't actually look for a quick fix. Like I will never say that. I will never advertise that. But often they are there as well, right? So like, for example, like I have a lot of like plantar fascia clients, Achilles tendinopathy. Actually, I take away the Achilles tendinopathy, but plantar fascia, like different foot issues and stuff like that. For example, I had a client maybe last year who had a sesamoiditis for a couple of years previous, and he was down to like doing 1,000 steps a day. And he had done a lot of things. He tried a lot of different pairs of shoes. He had done a lot of different pelvis exercises, foot exercises. And I did one online session with him, and I didn't make any promise or anything like that. I was just like, okay, let's have a look. And I gave him one exercise for his foot, and his pain pretty much cleaned up that day. And within 2 days, he was walking 10,000 steps a day.
Nice.
And it was just one exercise. Now, I'm still working with that client, and he has no pain. We're doing, he's flown over to work with me for like three different blocks. He lives in another country in Europe. We've worked a lot online. He's back running. We do a lot of plyometric stuff. So I look for the quick fix. If I feel like something's there, I'm not going to tell them this is what I'm doing, but I'm going to look for that. I'm going to search for that. I'm going to assess and reassess like several times within a session to see and to guide me as to what's actually changing and what's working here. But it's still with a long-term view in mind, because you will see a lot of clients, I know I'm kind of rambling here, but or you will see a lot of clinicians where they will go from one thing to the next, and they'll just say, is your pain gone after that? Is your pain gone after that? Is your pain gone after that? I try not to take that approach. It's like, okay, I can see that there's some things in your foot that I would like to get moving here and change how you maybe transition through the gait cycle. And even if we reassess and your pain is still there, I've still said to myself, like, this is a quality that I would like to give him back in his body. And maybe his pain is linked to it, maybe it's not, but I'm still going to train this. And maybe it will be the thing that gets rid of his pain, maybe not. But I look at rehab as skill development. What are the skills I need to teach someone along the way? And that was going to be a skill I would teach him anyway. And that just happened to be also the thing that like got rid of his pain. So that was like a big bonus along the way.
I like that. I like that you viewing rehab as skill development, because, you know, it's like along the way, for whatever reason, people have lost or they haven't like sharpened this in a while. Right. And so you have to give that, remind the body that they have that again. That's a fantastic way. I'm going to definitely steal that. I'm glad we're talking about the foot right now, because I wanted to ask a couple questions about this. So say, like, what do you think, one, is plantar fasciitis? Like, what the heck is going on with that? Because I know I get a lot of questions about that one, and I'm sure listeners would love to hear what your thoughts are on what the heck that is.
Functionally, I think it's for the most part, if you look at a foot, doesn't matter if it's a flatter looking foot, a higher arch looking foot, you can see people with either presentation getting those symptoms. I view it like a tendinopathy most of the time. And I would like to think about loading it like a tendinopathy. It seems to respond to load. It seems to be like, okay, yeah, this might not necessarily be reflected in the research all the time. It's just what I see. But I see people, when you consistently load it, it seems to help a lot. But what I do see with people who claim to treat plantar fasciitis or fasciopathy or plantar heel pain or whatever way they want to call it, they don't actually know how to load the plantar fascia to get it to fully lengthen and fully shorten very well. And to do that, you obviously to me at least, is you need to keep your heel down on the floor and actually load the three arches of the foot so that the foot is actually able to pronate very well and resupinate out very well. And if you look at someone with plantar fascia issues, regardless of the shape of their foot, what you will often see is that they can't change the shape of their foot and actually pronate and supinate. So lengthen the plantar fascia as they pronate and shorten it back out as they supinate. So that's what I will see. Now, I also had a case a few years back where a guy, it's quite a funny story, actually. I couldn't help but laugh when he told me he had an argument with his son, took his son's phone off him, threw it on the ground and went to stamp on his son's phone, and he missed the phone and he smashed his heel off the floor, and he ended up with like plantar fasciitis for 2 years in his foot. So, excuse me. So that probably didn't start with an inability to change the shape of his foot, but by the time he got to me, it still presented as the same thing, where his body just locked up that area, even though it was as a result of maybe a trauma in the first place. His body locked up that area and decided, okay, we had a massive trauma here, we're not going to move any of our foot anymore. So what is it? I view it as a tendinopathy. Why it happens, I don't know, because different types of people can, one guy's plantar fasciitis is another guy's Achilles issue, is another guy's shin splints, is another guy's knee issue. So load is definitely a big part of it, but what you see often, almost all of the time, is that they have an inability to change the shape of the foot.
Gotcha. So you almost think of it as like that area of the arch, like it's almost just holding isometrically throughout every movement that they're doing, taking every step, and to the point where the heel doesn't even want to stay on the ground. Would you say that they're probably biased more toward like a toe off position? Or do you see it for all different, you know, presentations of a foot?
They're more likely to be biased more forward in the gait cycle, because especially a lot of the time you will see toe grippers with plantar fasciitis. And that makes sense when you start to look at a foot. Actually, I probably shouldn't even say plantar fasciitis, because I think they're calling it plantar heel pain, just like they're saying it's not patellar tendonitis anymore. But yeah, you will see a lot of toe grippers gripping quite hard. And when you look at that, you're like, yeah, you just can't lengthen. You can't get into your midfoot whatsoever. So you'll also see a lot of tension maybe on the top of the foot, like a lot of extensor tone, tibialis anterior, all the extensors on the top of the foot are like pulling them forward a lot of the time as well. So they just can't change shape. They don't have a skill. The skill is, can they transition through the gait cycle? That's a skill. And they don't have that skill. It's not about someone, to me, it's not about someone accessing, can you access early stance, mid stance, late stance? Because everyone has their own version of early, middle, and late. It's actually that they can't transition effectively through the phases. It's the journey through the phases that they struggle with. And that's what a lot of these people with foot issues, almost regardless of the foot issue, they usually have.
Yeah, definitely. It's just like almost stagnant, congested tissue in a lot of ways. Would you ever recommend, and I know this is pretty broad, but say someone, you know, a lot of PTs here, the first recommendation they make is, let's put you in a different type of shoe, right? Or let's put you in the boot, which lengthens that out. Do you make shoe recommendations for these people?
Initially, I try not to. unless it's like a blatantly terrible shoe. Unless it's blatantly like just, oh my God, what is that thing? Then I will try not to, because I like to change one thing at a time. And usually I will do some foot exercises and teach their shin to move. So I'll coach the shin quite heavily, and I'll teach them to transition from early to mid stance usually. And I would like to try to do that before I made any changes at the shoe. That's my answer there. And I will spend a lot of time doing that. I will spend 3, 5, 8, 10 sessions working on a lot of that stuff, presuming we're seeing some improvements before maybe I would start to look into shoes a bit more closely. And I have quite a high success rate with that stuff. So I try to, because you can change the shoes, and this is an issue with some systems that I have as well, where they go straight to changing shoes. Or like, okay, it's presuming that someone can't pronate, we're going to get them into a shoe so they can sense their arch and push their arch down into the arch of the shoe and teach them to pronate that way. I understand, and I do appreciate, and I like that idea around the sensory aspect of it. Like, okay, now you can sense your arch. But they, to me, when I look at someone still walking through the gait cycle, they still don't know how to transition through the gait cycle. They still don't know how to change the shape of their foot. They just, you might give them a sense for a little while that this is where your arch is, and now you can sense it. And that sense lasts a little while. But when they don't know how to actually move their shin, let it drop forward, all this stuff, while keeping their heel on the floor, then I don't see that ever sticking, to be honest. So I make a long answer slightly shorter. Shoes wouldn't be the first thing I would focus on.
Right. No, I get that. And I have a similar view as well. I think they could be a useful tool depending on the person, but it's, mm-hmm. I'd much rather give them the musculature and the coordination aspect rather than just give them a shoe that would then give it to them, if that, yeah. Like, I guess artificially in some ways. So, I mean, do you ever make, I mean, you know, what's David Gray's shoe recommendations? Are you a barefoot kind of minimalist guy? Are you a supportive shoe?
I stay away from it. I've been staying away from, because I get that question all the time, and I've tried to not, like, I get that question both from like the clinician side and then the coach's side, or the client side. I try to usually my recommendation is what's most comfortable for you, just wear that. I have a variety of shoes myself. I have some Vivo barefoot, I have different barefoot shoes, I have like that ON running, which actually are quite padded or whatever. I have Nike shoes, I have Adidas. So I just wear a mix myself, whatever I feel like. And some days I like, for whatever reason, I'll just pick up a different shoe. I do like the PRI thought process a lot of the time, of if someone is in just working on flat ground all of the time, and maybe you feel like they don't sense their body too well, then I do like the thought process of, okay, maybe they should have a shoe with an arch in it, not to block pronation, but to actually sense that. So I do like that. I will maybe transition some people away from the barefoot if I feel like they're just completely locked up. But again, I do feel like, for the most part, if you can get their feet moving well, which involves actually teaching them how to move their feet well, not just pressing down into something, then I feel like you can, most people that I've worked with, or most people, not that I've worked with, but that actually have seemed to found a way to do that, they can wear whatever shoes they want and they feel pretty comfortable in them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's just, again, they're a tool at the end of the day, right? That we made them to protect our feet. So that's how I try to view it. I think there's some cases where you could maybe bias some tibial movement or something for those people that are super locked up, but just want people to be able to wear whatever the heck they want to wear.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's pretty, you know, let's be greedy, right? Be able to do whatever you want to do in that case. So
yeah,
no, I like that answer a lot. I think that's a good way to look at it. Sorry, my dog here is just, he's all wound up right now.
He's good. So, he's looking for a play.
Yeah, right. So kind of playing off the shoes and all that, what would you say are like three super underrated muscles, or just muscles that you find that like no one has access to, like when they come to see you?
Three underrated muscles. Good question. I will give you one anyway, and it's the glute max, and it's the opposite to how most people think about it, which is, because everyone would have thought the glute like as well, probably. If you ask anyone, it's like, well, maybe not underrated. It's certainly not underrated, but it's the ability to lengthen it is underrated, I would say. So really, yeah. Lengthening into the most meaty part of the glute max, because even so, in the traditional PT, like physical therapy, physiotherapy world, glutes are everything, right? So go after glutes for almost every single issue under the sun. In the training world, glutes are everything. If anyone's having any issue, they'll try and give you more glute, whether it's glute med, glute max, whatever. In the PRI world, let's say, like, glute, a right glute max is a big deal. In a lot of the other breathing stuff, people will talk about maybe, yeah, like, let's just leave it with PRI. So like one glute is really important, the other glute is less important. And so you'd want to get that right glute max to like push or turn the pelvis back to the left, or whatever way you want to put it. I see people let's say the pelvis is orientated to the right. I see them needing to like come back on both sides. They can't lengthen into any either glute ever. Right. So yeah. I don't know if I want to say three underrated muscles, but I will say lengthening into the glute max is probably the biggest one. And then maybe if I'll just throw one other one is probably the soleus, just how important that is. And that does go back to being able to drop the shin forward as well. That will load the soleus quite a bit and maybe get a little bit of tibial internal rotation. And your pronation, like that is what will load the soleus quite a bit. So that kind of goes along with the glute max as well, to be honest, because if you can drop the shin forward, I call that a tibial, an anterior tilt of the tibia, then you're going to get a posterior tilt of the femur, and a posterior tilt of the femur is going to get a very slight anterior tilt of the pelvis to go over that femur, and you'll get a ton of length into the glute max and the soleus at the same time. And then they're both big muscles that are loaded up and are going to help you with propulsion to push you forward then. So so yeah, I would say I'm going to give you two rather than three, but those two are really important.
What do you think about this is a muscle I've thought and I've stared at for a long time, especially around, you know, like narrow ISAs, but like the serratus posterior, like, is that something you've ever like messed around with or looked at much?
I used to try to do a little bit of manual therapy on it. But no, I haven't thought much about it recently over the last couple of years.
Gotcha. Yeah. I just think of, you know, especially you get those people with like the flared ribs. It's like, yeah, that area back there is just so compressed, if you want to call it that, tight. And so it's just been a spot that I've tried to like kind of open up. I don't know. I mean, I'm the same way, like, you know, throw a lacrosse ball back there, have fun, right? Just kind of open it up a bit. But like with reaching and all of that, like how it kind of plays into all of that. But I was just curious your thoughts on it. But
I've looked in a lot of. It's funny, when I first started looking into the breathing stuff a lot more, I was like looking around all these muscles and starting to like see all these different muscles and like how important all of them. You can pick out one and be like, that fucking thing there like must be having a big impact. So yeah. I went quite a bit down that rabbit hole, and I've kind of come back out of it a bit as well. And just focusing on like the bones, getting the bones moving, getting a good reach, getting a good exhale, getting a really good inhale, and leaving that do the job I need for. I have faith in the body that like if I can just coach the things that I need, these muscles will just do what they need to do as well. But if you ask me that question another 6 months, I'll probably have gone down some rabbit hole around two or three different muscles again. So I changed my mind on that quite a bit.
Yeah. It's easy to atomize and look at all this stuff, just pick out little pieces. But at the same time, it's like the body has to move as a whole unit. You know, your brain doesn't really recognize or it like what's a glute match versus, you know, a glute meet or something. Like it's just grabbing whatever gets leverage.
Exactly. So, it's just putting people in the position that, like, it gives no option for that muscle or whatever it is to just load the hell up. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment, but I probably will soon enough go back into like the anatomy of all those tissues all around there and dive in a bit deeper. Cause even though the way I coach it, like I just described, I do think it helps you when you start to go in, like you go into the micro and you start to look deep into some of these things and look at the lines of pull on them. And I think it helps. I think you can start to visualize like why someone or what's really tight on someone or why someone has ended up in the position that they're in. It might not change how you actually coach them and stuff, but our job as coaches is to try and understand this stuff and looking into anatomy. For the most part, the coaches that I see that have actually dived in and look at the anatomy of things, unless they get neurotic about it and like start to label one muscle as the most important muscle, unless they do that, for the most part, I see them actually, they're quite intelligent coaches and digging in to the micro usually helps people appreciate like how they all work together. So I think it's important.
Yeah, no, totally. I completely agree. I kind of want to talk about non-training stuff. And I think that is just as important, and it sounds like you're in a similar spot as me where you're just like kind of wanting to get away from it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, like, what's the other stuff that you're looking at right now? Are you just like looking at business, not like more so just like how to scale what you're currently doing, or are you reading like fiction? Like what are you getting into with that stuff?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out our business, Kyle. Trying to be really clear around what we're doing, what we're trying to do, where we're trying to go with things. That's on my mind all of the time at the moment, which is not necessarily a good thing, but it just feels like we're in a period of that, just trying to really figure that out. So we have like, I have like 50 things in my mind that we could do. And I don't know what the right decision is. Well, I probably do know what the right decision is, but then there's also like the micro side of things where it's like what the right platform to deliver this stuff is, and you know, all those little mini decisions. So those are things that I would like to not have to focus on and not have to think about. But we just don't have maybe the systems in place or the people in place to free up my time to think about the bigger stuff. So I'm trying to find a way. I've set a goal very recently to maybe to double our revenue over the next 12 months. And I'm trying to figure out what the best way to do it is. I just need to actually implement that. So it's a big enough goal, but I think it's quite an achievable goal for us. And it ultimately just comes down to, for the most part, just giving more value and giving people what they've been asking for, which is like a higher ticket offering. So that's what we're going to try and work on.
Yeah. Do you think that directly correlates to followers on social platforms? Like if you doubled your followers on Instagram, would you double your revenue?
Good question. No, I don't think so. We're in a position now where that's a good question, right? Because it's a time thing, because to put in the time to double my followers would mean it would take time away from me serving the people who are there looking for more stuff to buy from us right now. Mm-hmm. So I could double my followers. So basically what you're asking there is with regards to our businesses, are you going after more volume on the things that you're already selling? Or are you going after, are you just trying to get less people to buy, less new customers, but more lifetime value from the customers that you already have. So now the businesses who do the best do both. But at the moment, for us, the answer is we don't have time to do both. So we will keep growing our following as best as we can. And I've pushed that a lot more recently, and we've been doing a good job with that recently. But at the moment, we have a couple of products available. We have a lower body program, an upper body program, a core program. And each of those are only about €50 each. Then we have a membership site, which is $24.99 a month, and that's education for coaches and therapists, and they get education every week. Then we have workshops, which is our highest ticket offer, which is about, depending on where you are, like €500, €600 or dollars for a workshop. So if I double my following, we would probably double our customers. But we're still just selling individual programs for the most part to those customers. So then the question is, do you come up with a subscription follow along program? Do you come out with a course, a one high ticket offer course? It's €3,000, €4,000, €5,000. Do you come out with 10 different courses that are 250 each, which is like, okay, here's how you rehab this issue, this issue, this issue. So those are the questions that I have. So at the moment, we're just missing one high ticket thing, and maybe a couple of medium ticket offers. And I think we could easily double our revenue with two or three products with the followers that we have.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to look at it. Just, I mean, I've been blessed to get up to like 20K followers, which is great. And I love that. It makes me feel good. But I was able to make a full-time income off of just 2,000. Yeah. And, you know, for other coaches and like PTs and chiropractors listening, like, you can do that. It's just reaching out to the existing followers that are there. Like, they're already a warm lead. Mm-hmm. They're following you for a reason. So it's just, how can you better market and message to them and figure out what the heck they really, really want and provide a product for that. So yeah. I think that's a good way of going about it. Cause no matter what, like, you're going to post and you're going to grow, you know, they might. And at the end of the day, it's pretty much just a luck of the draw. Like, it's a crapshoot with whatever you post anymore. Like, who knows what's going to go off and what's not. Mm-hmm. So it's, I had one post go off and I got up to 1 million views. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. But it's like the dumbest post I've ever made in my life. I'm like, I don't want to be known for this.
And you wonder then what kind of followers like that post has attracted. And because it's hard to measure that. But like, are they the followers that are going to pay you money? And even if they do, would they be the followers that would buy a high ticket item? Maybe, exactly. But maybe not.
Well, so from that post alone, so my like metrics on Instagram, I had about like 60% like male following to like a 40% female. Mm-hmm. And this post was focused on the glutes. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I've literally flip-flopped my entire like the population of followers at this point. So now I have 60-65% women following me and only, you know, 40% men at this point. I'm like, well, you know, the people who actually buy from me are typically men.
Yeah.
So like, is this actually serving me in the future? I don't know. Like, I've actually had more female clients as of late. So I guess I'm making conversions at that point, but it's interesting how that can quickly like change just like that. And I mean, also like smaller accounts, I look at these big ones, I'm like, man, who knows what sort of their metrics look like. And I couldn't even imagine playing around with like 500,000 people at one time. Like, that's insane to me.
That's why they're going for volume, obviously, and they have, you see a lot of these accounts with 1-2 million followers, they have like 20 different programs available because they're trying to have a program available for every single person. I think in business, clarity is important, is the most important thing. Clarity of
totally
who you're trying to help, where you're trying to go, where you want to be in 5 years' time, not even 5 months' time, 5 years' time. If you're going to sell your business in 5 or 10 years' time, what would you, who would buy it from you? What would they be looking for? What would you be able to actually give them? What do you have that's actually, even, I don't care if people don't want to sell their business, but it's a nice thought experiment to think about, like, what assets do my business have to actually, that someone else could maybe buy? An Instagram account could be an asset that you could sell, right? In theory, much more likely someone wants your email list. Much more likely they want an email list that has a history of what interactions you've had with these customers, meaning like what programs they've bought, who are they professional, what age are they male or female, what are their interests, blah, 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 blah. So like, who's going to buy an email list if it's 100,000 people on it that is just like scattered with every single different type of person under the sun? Even if you are working with one-on-one clients and you end up with a ton of different clients with a ton of different interests and stuff, it's very hard for you to scale that. And it's very, very hard for you. I think you will get sick of that. So the cool thing with our growth is, since we've had about 5,000 followers up to, we're just about to hit 60,000 now, our conversions of our program sales and now our subscribers have been the same percentage all along. It hasn't changed. So we have 740 subscribers to our membership site, that for the educational site, and we have 60,000 followers on Instagram. Actually, no, here's a better metric for that. We have 700 subscribers, and we have about 10,000 people on our email list. So that's a very high percentage of those people that are on our email list actually are subscribing and paying us money every single month. We also have sold about 10,000 programs of Lower Body Basics, our first program, and we have 60,000 people on Instagram. They're all of those sales have come pretty much directly from Instagram, 99%, I would say. So if you look at accounts that have 1 million followers, only if they had 1% of their followers buying from them, that's huge. We have at least 10% of our followers that are buying from us. And they're, I would say, out of those 60,000 followers, probably 50% of those are actually, if I was to sit down and write down my target market, probably 50% of those actually fall into that target market, or maybe 30%. So I think those are metrics that people should be thinking about. And when people write a program and they just try and sell it to everyone, like, you have to expect that you're only going to sell it to 1% of your following, maybe, and 5%, 10% if you're doing a really good job or you're really clear about who you're marketing to. So I'm very careful with trying to get more and more followers. I think people don't charge enough money for most of their products, don't have a high ticket offer like we don't either, to be honest. And that's something that we're going to change this year and next year.
Right. Well, it comes down to clarity, and I completely agree. Like, I've definitely like looked at your website and some of your products and how you talk about them. And it's almost hyper specialized in some ways, the way you talk about them. I mean, even though you're as specialized as you can get with Lower Body, mm-hmm. right? But that's pretty dang clear versus, like, so I did a program called Broken a Beast, and I made the mistake of making it too broad.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's there, but it's like trying to combine way too many things at once. And it's just, you know, people look at it and they're like, what exactly is this? And then they're on to the next thing. Right. So, and that's where it gets tough.
Is that a one-off program? You just buy it one purchase.
Yeah. So it's just a one-off program, but so it's like a 3-month sort of full body. It could be, it's like a hypertrophy program, but it's for, you're done with rehab for the most part. You might still have some aches and pains, but it's still like pushing you in the right direction and reintroducing you into the gym. Supposed to run it for 3 months, but if you ran it for 6 months, you'd be sitting pretty.
What's the end goal there? If someone bought that program from you and did it for 3 months or whatever, would you like them then to sign up for one-to-one, or what would you like? What's the end goal of that program?
So the goal, it, that was just sort of the entry point, right? Like, it's like, here it is. It's for like $125 because there's a lot in it. It's got an ebook with it as well. And then my goal is to progress that into two other types of training. So either like a track-based workout, plyometrics, going more like power and athletic development, or getting back into more, not necessarily like more hypertrophy. Like, okay, you're just going to go into a bulk and add on like 20 pounds of mass, like mm-hmm. over the course of the next 6 months or something. So that's the end goal with those programs. And then along the way, like, I'm here if you need me, right? I've got like a Discord channel, which I think I'm going to switch over to a Facebook group, unfortunately. But that's really the end goal with it. It's just to let that be a product. But right now it's by itself. I've yet to launch the other ones at this point. So it's just sitting out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's tough because on the first time so for a lot of people that buy that program, it'll be the first time that they have interacted with your business.
Right.
And you're asking them to commit to 3 months on the first time.
Exactly.
So that's a tricky one.
Which is why, and you know, it's a learning process, right? Like, so I've already sort of like seen like, okay, like I do believe in the product. It's a good product. It's essentially a template that I use for all my clients that I work with, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I use all these exercises all the time. So it's there, but again, like you said, it's 3 months right off the bat. It's making a lot of almost too many promises at once mm-hmm. versus like, okay, lower body basics. What are you getting out of this? it's pretty simple, like what you get. So
I would think about for you, you can cut this out of the podcast or whatever if you want. This is completely unsolicited advice, by the way. So take it or leave it. I would think about creating a slightly lower ticket offer there and having a 4-week program, which is like, it obviously wouldn't be a hypertrophy program if it's 4 weeks, but something which gives a flavor of how you train. And then I would put that program that you've done and any other ones that you create into a subscription-based app or something like that, where they can access all of the programs that you've written for $25 or $50 a month, subscription-based.
That's the game plan right now. So I've got some stuff in the works to kind of go that direction. It's just a matter of getting it built and finding the time.
I know.
It's just the hard part. You have employees, correct?
I have Kira that works with me, so she does all the a lot of the admin operations and stuff. Then I have Chris is our coach who does a little bit of coaching with our membership site. Then we have Alice who does some physio, some of our online consultations, and but they're just consultants for us, like, let's say. And Kira works full time, but we could do it a few different people, to be honest. We could do it a techie type of person, and we could do it maybe a videographer type of person as well. So I think it's one of the disadvantages of being in Ireland, especially being where we are in Ireland, which is not necessarily in Dublin, where it's not as like, it's not a hub of, you know, like there's not a hub of techie people or videographer people or stuff like that. So yeah, the tech stuff is the thing that's holding us back probably the most, and just trying to figure out what the best things to do are, and that just takes too much of my time right now. So I need to figure that out. But yeah, I just what we're talking about there, I recommend people having a low ticket offer, which is like just getting some money off people. If it's $7, it could be $10, it could be $20, just to get them to part with their cash and say, okay, here we go. Like, you've put your hand up and say, now I'm willing to be a paying customer. Now I'm going to upsell you into something else. But you want to give them a win in the first 4 weeks, I would say. First week, actually, even if you can.
Yeah, totally. I think that's something you do really well, you know, like, because I've gone through lower body basics, and I think there's one thing that really sets your program apart, and that's sensation.
Yeah.
And so people feeling like their hamstrings, I remember I sent you a message like way back, and I was like, I've never felt my arches like the way I have with this, like doing that, these activities. I was like, what in the hell is that? And so when people feel that and they have that sensation, like that's buy-in. They're like, oh my gosh, what the hell just happened to me? Like I'm working hard. And I think that that's a huge win and something that, you know, makes people gravitate toward your products. So, I think that's your secret sauce.
it's an important, and I wrote the program in a way designed to, because I knew I'd hit backlash from people, because even the other day, one guy was like saying, he wrote to me and said, oh, I think he said like, oh, this is going to be too easy for me. I was like, we've had professional athletes from every single biggest sport in the world do this and actually improve how they play their sport and Olympians and stuff. It's not too easy for you. You just need to just go and actually do it. You haven't done one of the exercises yet. You just think it's too easy. So I wrote it in a way, and even just, for example, with one of the breathing exercises, the first exercise in it is a prone position. And a lot of people in the breathing world would say, oh, it's a rect, you're using a rectus dominant strategy in that exercise. Because we get people to like crunch quite a bit, protract quite a bit, get their ribs down and exhale as hard as they can. And people feel their abs screaming in that exercise. And it is a lot of rectus. But it's done for a reason, two reasons. One, it's not an upper body program or a core program or anything like that, where I'm trying to promote really nice rib cage expansion and all that stuff. There is some of that in it, but it's more about, I want to inhibit any of the erectors and the lower back, so that when they go and do the hamstring exercises, the hamstrings are working hard. It's not the lower back. So I'm just more interested in inhibition around the erectors. The second thing is, I want to build buy-in for the breathing stuff, and the amount of people that have done it. We have to bear in mind that these are people who never heard anything about a ribcage before in their lives. And they do that and they say, I felt my abs working really hard in that exercise. And then in the following exercises in it, we don't crunch as much. We talk about like internally rotating the ribs more than ribcage depression or anything like that. So you can try and be too smart in your programming, or you can just be like, what is the person? I need to think about the person that's going to do this. What sensation am I trying to give them? Do I want to humble them quite early? Probably you can humble them a little bit. And that straight away, they're like, okay, I know that was really hard. So actually I'm going to listen to David now, because like, I thought I was great and now I'm not so great anymore. So sequencing in a program like that, you have to give someone, I think when someone follows you, even on Instagram, like you want them to be getting a win from you in the first like 2 minutes. So like what are the videos that they're going to see first? When you have a program written out, what are the videos when they buy it or whatever? Like what's the win? How quickly can you deliver a win to someone? That's a really important question to ask for business.
Definitely. No, I love it, man. I know we're getting close on time here. I got one more question for you, and it actually relates to that rectus that I'm curious about. Or I guess not so much rectus, but with some of these exercises that you are, you know, getting a lot of sensation and like a ton of hamstrings burning, abs burning, do you think that it is like, do you ever teach people to stay a little bit more calm with some of the exercises? For example, like myself or working with like bodybuilders, they muscle their way through a lot of these breathing exercises. Like they are just flexing every single muscle that they have. They're bracing. I'm like, you probably need less of that and learn how to relax some of this. Is that something that you've seen or that you sort of coach and play with?
Yeah, 100%. So in upper body basics, like it's actually the exact opposite of lower body basics. Everything is like in the most relaxed way possible in the beginning. So we actually even have like a next section. When I was right, the issue, it took me so long to come out with upper body basics because I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about those type of people that you're describing. And I was like, they're going to go and do any of the reaching and any of the breathing. And even though I'm saying do it as soft as possible, they're going to be using their neck for everything. It's going to be so tense. So I just put in like a bonus neck section and it just taught them how to breathe in a way that like there is zero neck involvement whatsoever. I said, I have written in the program, I have a video that says like, if you have shoulder issues, elbow issues, tight chest, tight back, whatever, does it, and any of those things, and you have a tight neck, then do the neck section first, because that will teach you how to relax. And when you see a tight neck, you will see a rectus abdominis as well. They come together. So yes, and a lot of the time when I coach breathing work with one-to-one clients, I coach it in a very relaxed way. And I'm very specific with how I coach the inhale and the exhale and a reach and all of those things. But they already have buy-in for the most part. Whereas in lower, and again, in lower body basics, I'm just talking about inhibition. I just want to inhibit anything around the lower back so that we can get more hamstrings. So yes, definitely doing it in a more relaxed way is better for, I would say you can just probably presume that it's better for most people. And then you can always make it harder as you go along, but starting in a more relaxed way is going to be better for most people.
Well, I think too, what I found beneficial is, at least in the same exercise that I'm teaching, I'll, you know, maybe give them a rectus. I'm like, feel this, feel all the sensation. You got that? Mm-hmm. You know what it not to do now. Mm-hmm. and then relax from that. And I find that to be beneficial. Like, okay, this is muscling through it. Here's how we actually want to execute it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could see lower body basics leading into that with the upper body basics. So it makes sense to me. But David, I know we're getting close here, and I do apologize to anyone listening because they are literally changing the roof over here.
I can't hear anything.
Genuinely. That's good. I'm glad. I've been muting myself nonstop, but there's like a guy right there. Yeah. He's just watching me point at him. David, thank you so much. Hey, if you don't mind, hit us with the socials, hit us with the products, man. What all do you got out there?
So I suppose the best place for people to go is just David Gray Rehab on Instagram, GREY. And if people are interested in some of the stuff, they can go from there. So just have a look on Instagram. It's probably the best place. I appreciate you having me on, Kyle. I'm sorry for my rambling and my voice and my incoherent thought process. I think I need another coffee, maybe. I'm always like, not, I have no empathy for people when they're sick. I'm like, if that was me, I would just power through it, blah blah blah. And then when I'm sick, I'm like, I can't actually even think straight here. So yeah. It's been great to chat. I think you're doing some really good stuff. I hope the podcast is going well. I know how hard I have a big appreciation for any podcaster now, because I know how hard it is. One of the hardest things I've done. So kudos for chipping away at that.
I appreciate it, man. Well, all those, that link will be down in the show notes, everyone. And thank you all for listening.